From the studios of Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. At 6931 Hollywood Boulevard, there is a star on the Walk of Fame with the name of this week's guest, Milt Larson, along with his brother, the late Bill Larson. The two men are the creators of the Magic Castle, the legendary nightclub and gathering place for the world's greatest prestidigitators, illusionists, and ventriloquists. Milt Larson is also an historian of American entertainment, a radio host and television writer, a playwright, a recording artist and songwriter. His new book is Milt Larson, My Magical Journey, The First 30,000 Days. Milt Larson, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
I love talking to you. I think that's great. After hearing all my credits, I'm too important to talk to, so goodbye.
Well,
it's called the Jack of All Trades and Master of None, but I have done a lot of those things. So
I could have listed some more of your credits in my introduction, but our show's only a half hour.
Well, that's great.
Well, now, I really enjoyed your book. It's a great book, a wonderful read. But now, you come from a family of entertainers.
Right. Well, I was kind of born in a magic trunk, and my mother and father were both very active in magic. My dad was a criminal attorney, but he loved magic, and later even took the Larson family on the road, playing resort hotels as the Larson family of magicians. So, yeah, I grew up with magicians, and all my life I've had everything I've ever done kind of comes back to having something to do with magic. So it's a pretty rewarding way to go. It's been a lot of fun.
Now, you know, Houdini was always looking for a real medium. You know, he famously uncovered lots of fake ones, looking for a real one.
Right.
What about you? Do you believe there is real magic in the world?
Well, I think everything in the world is magic. So how about that? If you really consider it, you know, magic is the sun coming up in the morning, and all that kind of thing. But I think what Houdini was looking for is his mother passed away, and he was very interested in psychic phenomena, and particularly the idea that somebody could be contacted after they're dead. And so he spent a great deal of his life trying to expose, not trying to, but exposing spirit mediums, who claimed to be able to contact his mother, and then they could never quite do that. And Houdini had a pact with his wife that whoever should die first would try to contact the other, and they had a code worked out. So if somebody said they were talking to the spirit, if the spirit didn't know the code, then they, just like computers today, you know, password, you don't get in, you know. So So at any rate, he passed away in 1926, and they had spirit seances for the next 10 years trying to contact Houdini, and nobody ever was able to come up with that one secret code. And they had a final Houdini seance in 1936, 10 years after he died, and that was supposed to be the last. It's a very interesting story about that. If we have time to tell a story, I'll tell a little story.
Go ahead, tell.
But they were holding the final Houdini seance, and they had bleachers set up on the top of the old Knickerbocker Hotel in Hollywood, and it was a big deal. My mother and dad were there, and trying to prove if Houdini could really come back, and they cajoled and cajoled, and it was a nice night in Hollywood, but Houdini never came back. And at the very end of the seance, Mrs. Houdini turned out a little light that had been burning for 10 years and said, "Houdini hasn't come back. Goodbye, Perry," and that was about it. And at that time, there was a rain shower in Hollywood, and it rained just long enough to drench everybody on the roof of the Knickerbocker Hotel. And the weird thing about it was it didn't rain any place else in Southern California. It just rained
just that one
that
spot
part of Hollywood. Huh. So the people that said he could come back or couldn't come back said, well, he didn't come back, and the people that said, well, they still didn't prove anything, because maybe he came back in a storm and was mad enough to get everybody wet. So it's an interesting story, but that is true. I mean, that's what happens. So, you know, who knows? At the Magic Castle, we do a final Houdini seance, kind of a show, and it's kind of a Disneyland type of thing, quite honestly. We don't bring back Houdini twice nightly, but he does show up. So if the fuse blows, he doesn't come back, you know.
Oh, it's an illusion.
Darn right.
Well, Milt Larson, you just mentioned Disneyland, and one of the things I wanted to ask you about is in your book, you were present, you attended the opening of Disneyland.
I was there. Yeah, it's I was working on a TV show at the time, and they invited just about everybody that was at the studio to go to the opening of Disneyland. So it wasn't I was a terribly important person. I was just one of the young writers on a show. But it was quite an evening, and everybody thought that Walt Disney was crazy because he was building this park out in the middle of nowhere at that time. You know, Orange County and Anaheim was kind of a spot just a little bit beyond all the freeways. So they thought he was crazy, but I guess he proved that he wasn't.
Now, did you mentioned in your book how much you admired Disney? Did you ever meet him? I mean, you worked on Bedknobs and Broomsticks, so you must have.
I had the great pleasure. I've worked. One of my best friends in the world is Richard Sherman, who the Sherman brothers, who wrote Mary Poppins and
you bet.
It's a Small World and
now that song, now
all
that
all the Disney shows and Dick and I go back to when we were writing songs together back when we were very young and we still write songs, but his main credits with his brother were, two Academy Awards and 9 nominations, and my work with Dick is a couple of kind of crummy old LPs, but that's about it. But the thing was, in knowing Dick and working with Dick, I had occasion a few times to go out to the studio and have lunch at the table. You know, I had a table of friends and executives every time for lunch, and I got to sit down a couple of those. What was really kind of my role model, I mean, and all the things I've done, I've produced magic shows for over 50 years and shows at the castle and TV specials. But everything I've done has been family entertainment, and I always I figured that, if Walt Disney could do it, I could do it. And it's, I guess if I ever admired anybody more than anybody else in my life, it'd be Walt Disney.
Well, of course, your album, Smash Flops, that you created. It's you just underplayed it, but that's a terrific album, and everybody loves it.
Well, the thing is, we wrote our smurst. How about that one? our first smash flop back in 1959 or something like that, and we were doing an act for the characters in Las Vegas, and they needed a special material, and we couldn't think of anything to do, and then Dick remembered that his father, or Dick was commenting one time that his father wrote a song called Lindbergh, the Eagle of the USA, and his father was a very famous songwriter also, and I said, well, what would have happened if Lindbergh hadn't made it? If he, the plane fell in the Atlantic Ocean, that would be the end, because obviously they wrote the song assuming he was going to make the trip, because he came out like the day after he did it. And we said, well, that's a fun idea. So we wrote a song called Bon Voyage Titanic. And the whole album was based on commemorative songs, assuming there was going to be a wonderful thing to sing about, and then something went wrong, like the Titanic.
Can you give us a little, Milt Larson, can you give us a little taste? How did that song go? Can you sing it for us?
Well, I'm singing this, but Bon Voyage to you, new Titanic. You're the greatest ship on the blue. Bon Voyage to you, new Titanic. I'm so lucky to be sailing with you. Some of our songs, one of my favorites was The Spruce Goose, about Howard Hughes and his flying airplane. And one of my favorite lines out of that is, when the spruce goose takes to the sky, proving lumber yards can fly.
They don't write them like that anymore.
As you're flying up there to new heights, all you have to fear is termites. You know, it was a plywood boat.
That's right.
Now, we had a lot of fun, actually, between the original Smash Flops and there's a band Barbershop Ballads, which is basically another one. And those are still around. If anybody goes to iTunes and goes Sherman and Larson, they'll
find
to hear them all. So please do.
Yeah, but not until the show is over.
Yeah.
You did an album, while Slime was around the subject of albums, you did an album with Boris Karloff.
Mm-hmm.
I love
Boris.
Karloff.
Well, we were able to negotiate with the Universal for the soundtracks of all the monster pictures. And that Boris, who is a wonderful, wonderful gentleman, and he narrated the album for us. It was called Boris Karloff and His Friends. And the funny thing is, we bought the rights, negotiated the rights with Universal to make a record. And then, as you do in the record business, you shop it around and try to get the record company to release it. And we shopped it around, and RCA, Columbia at those days, and nobody really wanted it. Then finally, Decca bought it, and Decca was a big, huge company, and they bought it and they put it out. And the only problem was they forgot, or they really didn't realize it. Decca was owned by MCA at that time, which was Universal. So, so they bought their own rights.
They bought the rights from themselves.
They got the rights from us, paid us for it, and they were buying their own rights, which made them really unhappy. But that's just another one of the anecdotes. I tell you, my book, the Magical Journey, it's a lighthearted thing of all the crazy things that can happen to a person. It has no message whatsoever. The only message in the book is enjoy life and have a great time like I did, I put that in the past tense. I'm not gone yet.
No, we're only 30,000 days in.
You're darn right.
But, it's this book also has some, it's just a marvelous scrapbook of beautiful photographs, memorabilia and so forth of the things that you and I both love. And it also is a real history of show business. You talk a great deal about the history of vaudeville and some of the beautiful theaters, which then you...
I was the president of the Society for the Preservation of Variety Arts, and that's a new organization called SAVE, but it devoted to really saving and preserving the variety arts, which includes all the burlesque and circuses and vaudeville and comedy and all that. And when you go to the Huntington Library in Pasadena and look up what they have the first seven folios of Shakespeare, but they don't have a whole lot of burlesque sketches. So my feeling was to save all that really good, dreadful material that's out there. And, nobody really appreciated the value of the great old vaudevillians who travel the country spreading the news and doing songs and things. So I've always been a big champion of that. There's a little thing in my book of I was born the year vaudeville died. The vaudeville was considered the official death of vaudeville was when the Palace Theater in New York closed as a two-a-day house, and that was basically the year that I was born. So I think I was put on earth to save vaudeville. I haven't done it yet, but I'm still working.
Well, there's plenty of time. One of my favorites, we're talking to Milt Larson, and his book is called My Magical Journey, The First 30,000 Days. One of my favorite television programs, people always talk about Bob Barker and how great he was as the host of The Price is Right, and he's well remembered for that, but I remember him as the host of Truth or Consequences.
You did a very good...
the only game show with a city named after it.
Right. Well, the wonderful thing about Truth or Consequences, and I had the really good fortune of... I was only 25 years old when I started on that show, and the show had been on the air as a major hit television show with Ralph Edwards for 15 years before I got there. And I wrote it with two other writers for 18 years. But I just got this really great job of the wonderful thing about, you say, a game show. It wasn't really a game show. It was a audience participation show, and that would be like the first of the reality shows. We'd take people out of the audience and put them in positions where they might be singing opera, or they might be doing some strange comedy sketch with famous stars or whatever it was. It was a marvelous, marvelous show, and Bob Barker was, the writers called him the world's greatest MC. A lot of the shows today, there's a lot of the hidden camera and things, and Ralph Edwards, who owned the show, would never have let us do anything that we really embarrassed anybody with. I mean, that humiliated them or anything. You know, we would have never done a thing where people were forced or eat worms or anything.
No.
Blech, yuck. But what we would do is it would always be a joke, and it would be like a private playing a joke on a sergeant, or it would be the wife playing a joke on a husband, or the secretary playing a joke on the boss.
Yeah.
And, you know, in the old days of Charlie Chaplin, you would never, ever have a charwoman slip on a banana peel.
That's not funny.
But it was fine if you had a stodgy old banker slip on a banana peel. And basically, that's what we did. We had fun with people, but we never would put them into a position where they'd be totally embarrassed. Now, that didn't mean that we had our share of pie throwing and dunking people in tanks and everything. But the thing is that the husband would be hanging over a tank of water, and the only reason he got dunked is because of his wife on stage was answering the question wrong, and he projected that she was going to answer a different way. And it's the same thing of the county fair where they dunk him in a tank because they don't answer the question or something. Truth or Controversy is a very pure comedy stunt show, and I guess that's the nicest way to do it. But part of it, you know, when we did reunions where we bring two people together that hadn't seen each other for a long time, and that was the start of Ralph Edwards's This Is Your Life. And he stopped doing TRC and started doing This Is Your Life, and then at that time a couple of other people took over Truth or Consequences. So it's really, in my life, it's been a pleasure to have been part of it. But you know, the thing that happens now, you know, when my book, The First 30,000 Days, that refers to the fact that I've been doing stuff for 30,000 days, which you do the math, and that ends up with an octogenarian type person, which is me. But the thing I get now is that people say, you know, say, oh, you wrote Truth or Consequences. I love that show. That was such a wonderful show. I never had so much fun laughing. I remember I'd get out of kindergarten to go watch the show. And that makes a person feel a little elderly.
Well, it was a while ago, but it was a great show, and it lives on in our memories. But And, you know, you mentioned This Is Your Life, Ralph Edwards' other famous program, and I understand that when he had Laurel and Hardy on This Is Your Life, that you sat and entertained them for a while. Is that correct?
Well, Ralph knew that I loved the older comedians and the older performers, and I did. When I was a kid growing up, I started collecting the records and everything, but and I really liked those, and Ralph, my boss, knew that. So on This Is Your Life, when they were doing the surprises, they absolutely, it was a very pure show. Nobody ever knew who they were surprising except the staff, and they were really secret about it. So what they had to do is whoever the subject of the show was, they had to know where they were prior to the show for a limited part of time, so they knew that when they... Now, remember, we're talking about live television, you know, I mean, really live television. When the big hand got to the top of the dial, you were on the air. So they had to know that a person was safely occupied. So Ralph would call me up and say, Melody, so would you mind taking Edwin to lunch?
Wow.
or would you mind spending some time with Max Sennett, who's, Keystone Cops,
mm-hmm.
or Stan Laurel, or people like that, actually Lauren Hardy. But so I got to meet, when I was a youngster writing for Truth or Consequences, but I got to meet these wonderful legends of show business, the Buster Keatons and all those people.
What a thrill that must have been.
Well, I got to tell you, Ralph called me up one time, and part of the This Is Your Life show, at the end of the show, if you remember those shows, they give the subject a 16-millimeter sound projector and a kinescope, they called it in those days, of the show, you know.
Right.
As part of what they would get, because they'd get something. And anyway, so Ralph got me up one day, and he said, Mount, he said, would you mind going out to Stan Laurel's apartment in Santa Monica and show him how to work the projector? He can't figure out how to work the projector. well, I was a home movie, a home theater nut at that time, and I love projectors, and Ralph knew that. So anyhow, I had the great pleasure of going out to Stan Laurel's house in Santa Monica and being greeted by my idol. I love Stan Laurel. And hello, Mr. Lawson. Now just be able to come and fix my projector for me. I said, well, Mr. Laurel, it doesn't need fixing. It needs turning on. But I said, there's a bit of a trick to it. So I threaded up the film, and then I had it all set. So that he, and he was playing cards with another couple and being just delightful. And he said, well, join us. And I had a little toddy with him. He said, you know, we're having a little something to do. Would you have something to drink? And, oh, yes, I'd like to do that. And it never did turn on the projector. I had a good time. And as far as I know, Stan never watched the film ever again. But, you know, those experiences are just priceless, you know, especially, you know, to be able to be in the shadow of greatness with those kind of people was just fantastic to me. And I just lucked into it. It was a great way to grow up. And the same thing with magicians. Because of the family and all the things we had to do with magic, I guess I probably met more famous magicians in my life than anybody, because they were always there, and they'd come out to our family house, and we had Dad had a magazine for magicians and was very popular in magic. So it's amazing the people you meet in your life that you look back and say, oh my God. When I had the Variety Arts Center downtown, it was filled with memorabilia of people, and I had a little habit which I kind of later was sorry I did, because I'd find the oldest picture I could find of somebody, and then I'd have them sign it, you know, to Milt from Jack Benny, you know. And then later in life, I've got pictures that were probably photographs from 1920s or even before that, and it says to my good friend Mel Larson.
So now they think you're 100 years old.
They said, how old can this guy be? You
know? Well, first he spoiled vaudeville, he killed vaudeville, and now...
But I've still got all those collections. I cherish them, and I'm kidding about it, but it's really so nice to meet those giants of the industry and on a kind of one-to-one basis when... You know, they're huge stars, and you're a kid. So I had that in growing up, and that's kind of what I talk about in the book, too.
And you and your brother created the Magic Castle. Tell us about that.
Well, the Magic Castle was... my brother was a staff producer at CBS, and I was the writer on Truth or Consequences. At that time, it was on NBC. And we were doing okay in the in the TV business, but my dad, I talked about it, passed away at a very early age. He was only 48 when he passed away, and he always had the idea for doing a club for magicians, and and talked about it in his editorials in the magazine, and at one time started the idea for Academy of Magical Arts as an organization. But then about a year after that, he passed away, and it was dormant for quite a while. And then, talking about truth and consequences, my offices, the writer on the show, was at the corner of Hollywood Boulevard and Highland in Hollywood, and I was overlooking this really grand old mansion that was left over, well, it was built in 1910. Yeah, but it was in disrepair, and it really looked kind of like it had fallen out of an old Charles Adams cartoon. I mean, the weeds and the lawn and the really looking like a haunted house, let's put it that way. And so I'm kind of daydreaming about, gee, wouldn't that be a neat place to have a club for magicians? And one day I met the owner of the property. It was a very, very large piece of property of the entire hillside of Hollywood, and the owner of the property really have never quite figured out what he wanted to do. He bought it because it was part of a larger piece of property that he wanted, and so I told him about the idea, and we got together, and he leased the property to me, and we started a thing called the Magic Castle, which was the clubhouse, and still is, for the Academy of Magical Arts, which is the organization. So my brother put the organization together as a nonprofit organization of magicians, and then I was kind of a do-it-yourself nut, and had a love carpentry and love restoring old buildings and things. So I took on the challenge of turning an old house into a elaborate clubhouse for magicians. And that was 50 years ago. We just had our 50th anniversary of the opening of the castle. And it started as just a small club with about 150 magicians that thought it was a good idea. And now it's international. We have 5,000 magicians throughout the world. And the main clubhouse is recognized as kind of the mecca for magic in the entire world. So it's an accomplishment we're very, very proud of, and the castle now is kind of like a adult Disneyland. You know, we have four theaters and bars, a beautiful restaurant, and the main thing in the castle is it's a place where magicians entertain people that love magic. But it's a private club. You can't really go there just wandering in off the streets. But on the other hand, the Academy of Magical Arts is always looking for new members. And if anybody would like to know more about it, they can go to the website, which is magiccastle.com, and get all the information. But we're very proud of the castle, and that's one of the reasons that Bill and I have the Star on the Boulevard and all that, is just the effort of creating something that wasn't there before we did it, and now it's kind of a institution, if you will. So how many of those can you do in your life, you know?
Well, I guess a few if you're Milt Larson. And you should also be very proud of this book. It's called My Magical Journey, The First 30,000 Days. We've hardly gotten a chance to talk about a third of the things in there. But, Milt Larson, thank you so much for visiting with us on From the Bookshelf.
It's a great pleasure, and thank you for asking me.
And that closes the book on this week's edition of From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the show, and you'll come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can also find us on iTunes and Facebook. I want to thank my guest, the amazing Mr. Milt Larson. His book, My Magical Journey, The First 30,000 Days. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time.